that's been around for a long time, and I think is very well motivated by things that we know about the world. Anyway, I'm going to discuss mostly a recent paper with my two students, Xi Dong and Bart Horn, and a postdoc, Gonzalo Taroba, which is building up from work that I did last year with Joe Kolchinski. And it fits very well with some earlier studies of basically the sitter space and inflation done with these co-authors. And here are some references for related other work. So let me just back up. The name of our game is basically to try and understand what are the minimal set of degrees of freedom that we need to describe our world. And of course, our world is cosmological and doesn't have the kinds of extra symmetries like supersymmetry that theorists love to use, at least as a crutch, at the scales we've seen so far. And so we'd like to understand what are the degrees of freedom and how do they arrange themselves to describe appropriate observations. And as has been discussed now a number of times in this conference, there's a beautiful duality that allows us to formulate quantum gravity in certain kinds of backgrounds, these anti-de Sitter backgrounds and close relatives. But these are not the realistic ones. The realistic ones have cosmology and inflation, probably, certainly at late times, and accelerated expansion. So we'd like to understand and answer this question in that context. So what I'll do today is derive, building up from ADS-CFT, a concrete step toward this, which is a semi-holographic formulation of such space-times, which is a notion that is very simple that I'll explain. And so this will be enough to give us a parametrically, in terms of certain discrete parameters, a microscopic accounting of the Gibbons-Hawking entropy of the sitter, which is one of the clues that we have to guide us in looking for the right degrees of freedom of this kind of space-time. So let me go back up and first describe the classic ADS-CFT duality. On the gravity side of this correspondence, there's some so-called warp space-time, which means that there are space-time slices, which are those on which the field theory lives, which, as a function of some other radial coordinate r, have a strong gravitational redshift factor sitting here, so that if, as you move in the radial direction, you're effectively rescaling the size, or equivalently the energy scale, of the CFT, of the quantum field theory that you're studying. So this extra radial direction is like the scale, or as it keeps calling it, the resolution of the field theory. And in this, in the kind of pristine version of this duality, one has such a description that pertains from zero gravitational redshift, or rather very strong, arbitrarily strong gravitational redshift, all the way up to where this G0-naught warp factor goes off to infinity. And as r goes to infinity, that describes the UV, the very deep ultraviolet of the quantum field theory. And conversely, small r here describes the infrared physics of the quantum field theory. So that was a macroscopic description of the correspondence. And there's a microscopic to go along with it in many, many different examples. In fact, this is how it was discovered by Malvasena, was to take these extended objects, these D-brains of string theory that have been introduced previously in the conference, and study them in two ways. So one considers a collection of such extended brains, which I'll call color brains, because they contain a Yang-Mills gauge theory on them with a certain number of color degrees of freedom, like in QCD, which is the number of those brains. And there can be other defects, which I'm referring to here as flavor brains, which encode degrees of freedom, which are analogs of quarks in QCD, flavors charged under the Yang-Mills group. And one looks at a system like this in a low energy limit, in terms of this Yang-Mills theory that I referred to, which, because of the gravitational redshift factor that is sourced by the brains, corresponds to the limit where you go geometrically very near to the object, the so-called near horizon region. And if you do that, the gravity solution looks more like this than like this. Here I was just, here I'm depicting the set of brains in some asymptotic flat, locally flat geometry, a cone generally. And if you go toward the near horizon region, what happens is that the flux sourced by these brains, kind of a higher dimensional generalization of magnetic flux, balloons out, it pushes out on the sides of these directions so that it eventually stabilizes them at a constant value, and the gravitational redshift factor comes in the way that I described in the previous slide. Okay, so this is, again, just a brief review of the macroscopic and microscopics of ADS-CFT. Next, I'll need a generalization of this, which actually loses some of the power of it, but it's the version that we'll be able to generalize to the cosmological setting. And that goes under the name of warp compactifications or Randall-Sundrum geometries, where what one does then is consider a system where the gravity solution that I just mentioned pertains in some region of scales of this value of the radial coordinate r that is cut off somewhere at some, you know, finite value of r, which, as we've discussed, is a scale. So we're looking at a system which is well described by the dual field theory at low energy, but at this cutoff scale, something else happens. It is cut off, and one of the insights of Randall-Sundrum that was very basic was that in this kind of situation, basically because this r coordinate doesn't go off to infinity and the integral of the Einstein term down this radial direction is finite, you find that gravity in four dimensions, in the d minus one dimensions along that the field theory lives on, remains dynamical. So the Planck mass in four dimensions is still finite. And so, as I've said, one still gets a lot from holography here. The best description of this field theory is still the gravity side, but it's, you know, describing a field theory which does not extend all the way up into the deep UV, but is cut off and coupled to gravity. Okay. So now I can explain why I say that that is what is relevant for the Sitter holography, as I've introduced it. And for that, we just need to make a simple observation about a very useful way of slicing the De Sitter metric, or of expressing the metric of the Sitter space in D dimensions as follows. It's just a true fact that the D-dimensional De Sitter metric can be written as a warped compactification down to D minus one dimensional De Sitter, where the warp factor, gravitational redshift factor that I was talking about before, goes to zero, actually in two places where the sine function goes to zero, and rises up to a finite maximum in the middle. So this is just a essentially kinematical statement about the metric of the Sitter, that it is a warped compactification with two of these warped throats, so one on each side. Again, each of the throats is where the sine goes to zero here. Because of that, just macroscopically, this system has a right to a holographic dual description where the low energy region, where the gravitational redshifting is very strong, is described by a field theory, but that field theory is cut off at some finite scale and then coupled to the d minus one dimensional gravity, which still propagates. So we can expect a holographic description of the Sitter and its, you know, decays and its cousins, which at the very least accomplishes this kind of semi-holographic duality familiar from actually more complicated warp compactification and familiar from the Randall-Sundrum kind of toy models with two throats. So again, this kind of description of holography for warp compactifications has precedence in most most concretely, I'd say, in the work of Klebanov and Strassler and Giddings, Cotru, and Palchinsky, where a warped throat, whose field theory is the Klebanov-Strassler field theory, some kind of Yang-Mills theory, basically, is explicitly embedded in a compactification, which cuts it off smoothly and couples it to lower dimensional gravity. And there it's well known that the holographic dual description of this is what I've said, this field theory at low energies cut off and coupled to gravity. Okay, so the point here is that De Sitter has this same structure, and so we want to understand, in this case, in some concrete examples, microscopically, what are the degrees of freedom that make up these throats, and in so doing, you know, check our interpretation of all of this. Okay, so let me proceed then to review one more aspect of this kind of semi-holographic duality that's relevant because I mentioned the entropy. So in warp compactification or Randall-Sundman theories, it's the case that you can understand there's already one check on the whole thing that works as follows. So I mentioned that the D minus one dimensional graviton still propagates, and the simplest way to characterize that is that the D minus one dimensional Planck mass, or the inverse Newton constant, in fact, equivalently, is finite. That comes from integrating down that warped throat, taking into account the square root of the determinant, in fact, that the geometry is shrinking. Okay, so we can determine this Planck mass by doing that integral, and it not surprisingly scales like the radius of the De Sitter space times the d-dimensional inverse Newton constant. So that's fine. That's just the gravity side calculation, which is a classical, you know, geometrical calculation. So we can just rewrite it trivially in this suggestive way, where we pull out factors of R in this way. The first combination being the scaling of the De Sitter entropy in any dimension, and the second factor being the cutoff scale. So the upshot is that you can look at the lower dimensional Planck scale in two ways. One is just on the gravity side, do the integral, dimensionally reduced. And on the field theory side, what this is a induced contribution to the Planck mass in lower dimensions is coming from the large number of degrees of freedom, the large entropy of the dual theory. Okay, so again, as I keep saying, this is all macroscopic, and much as in the corresponding problem in black hole physics, we like to understand microscopically in some, you know, examples that are explicit enough what are these degrees of freedom that fill up the throat. What we're going to do is a very just simple-minded approach, which is to start with ADS-CFT, whose microscopic description I reviewed earlier in terms of these color brains, and whose near-horizon geometry gives a compactification down to ADS space. Add ingredients to that, which uplift the ADS solution to a De Sitter solution, just macroscopically. Add ingredients that do that. And see what that did to the underlying brain construction. Okay, that's the goal. And what we will find is that the process of uplifting in this way automatically converts a brain construction like this, where we have this radial coordinate that went off to infinity, instead to one that is compact for a very simple reason. And that compactness forces us to introduce two sets of color objects, for the flux sourced by one to end on the other. And those are our two throats. So that structure jumps out at us from this microscopic point of view as well. So that's going to be basically the upshot. And I want to explain why and show you an example that we've worked out of this, which is kind of fun. It's kind of also technical and tedious, but it's at least an existence argument for a concrete example of this. Okay, so the example that I'll build from is kind of a now a classic example in string theory, this ADS3 times S3 times T4 kind of example that was derived from the original black holes that people had, whose entropy people had understood. And so in particular for the purpose of this talk, the concrete example I'm going to do is actually going to be in three dimensions going down to two. So we'll have no pretense of realism, unfortunately. But it's a conceptual question, and so we wanted to do it in the simplest possible place. Anyway, so there's a classic example of ADS-CFT where you can pack define a four-dimensional torus times basically a sphere or an orbifold of the sphere to get down to ADS-3. When you compactify, you dimensionally reduce the theory to obtain an effective theory, in this case, three dimensions, in real life, four. In this example, the effective potential for this ADS model can be written down in terms of the various size scales of the problem, the size of the sphere, the size of the torus. The sphere itself has a structure of a circle that varies over an S2, the top vibration. We keep track of those various radii, and there's some effective potential for them, which exhibits an anti-de Sitter minimum in a nice and simple way. So here one has fluxes from these color brains that I described, which come in two kinds, from D1 brains and D5 brains, which correspond to seven-form fluxes and three-form fluxes. So there's flux filling the torus and other flux not filling the torus. That balances to stabilize the size of the torus, and then the radius, some combination of the radius and the string coupling are stabilized by the contribution to the potential energy that comes from the curvature of the sphere. So when it's starting in 10 dimensions, integrating the Einstein term, which is the curvature, down to get contributions to the potential. So that gives us these first terms. That, combined with the energy contained in these fluxes, stabilizes the model at a negative cosmological constant. So in a slight cartoon, the basic idea in ADS-CFT stabilization is that you have some positive curvature, which contributes negative potential energy, and it plays off against flux. So I was describing this the brain construction for such examples, and I'm going to say one more thing about it, which is almost tautological in this context, but will be the thing which immediately shows us the difference between this and the de Sitter case. So I mentioned these ADS-CFT brain constructions, which are color brains at the tip of some cone, a locally flat space. And just to belabor the obvious, a cone satisfies a kind of radial version of the Friedman equation, where one considers, let's keep track of the radius of this three sphere as a function of the radial coordinate r here. It satisfies this equation, which is like a Friedman equation, except now I've replaced time by radius, and because of that, the sign of the curvature that produces a good solution, where the radius or scale factor varies linearly with, in this case, radius rather than time, is positive curvature. So I'm just belaboring the fact that this flat metric gives us a solution to the constrained equation, one of the Einstein equations that can be written as essentially a Friedman equation in the radial direction. So what we'll want to do is start from an example like this, uplift it to get a de Sitter solution instead, so add degrees of freedom, which change this potential, which gave us the solution at negative CC, to one that has a solution at positive CC, and see what happened to this and this in the process of doing that. Okay. Any questions so far? This is all very pedestrian. To go from here to here, you need more structure in the potential, and the simplest way to do it, given that all terms in the potential kind of trivially go to zero, potential at large radius and weak coupling, one needs at least three independent terms of the potential to achieve the sitter stabilization in all the expansions and couplings and inverse radii. So I'll tell you an example later, and you know, there's a whole program of research of people working out the sitter solutions that are simpler and simpler. But for the purpose of this, the basic gist of this, let me just for now grant that there is such a solution, which has the structure. Well, what's it going to do? If you did something like change the sign of the curvature term, this first term, and then introduced a negative term, and such terms do exist in string theory, they come from oriented folds, then this Friedman equation that I had before, which I belabored, had a plus sign for the curvature term, and now, because of this uplifting, it has a minus sign. And there's this negative term that must be included on the right-hand side with the opposite sign. And that's going to be some constant over a power of the radius, which had better be larger than the leading uplifting term. That's all we really need to know. It's going to be true for anything that gives us the sitter. And for the purposes of determining the brain construction, we want the analog of this cone. So we're going to take away the color brains and the flux and just ask, again, for the analog of this cone, and that's why I didn't include other terms here. But now you see what happens when you do this. What you're getting is, instead of a radial analog of an open universe, you're getting a radial analog of a closed universe. It's going to be closed for the usual reason that, you know, if you look at this equation, if R gets too big, the right-hand side changes sign, and that's impossible, so it comes back down. Okay, so that's just basically the qualitative point, and it's again why one gets, instead of a single throat of an ADS CFT dual pair, one gets the two throats that one expected macroscopically in the de Sitter case. It'll be anti V1 and anti V5, but in the limit, in the regime where it's all flux. So yeah, so it's gonna be metastable, but the decay is exponentially slow. Any other questions at this point? So I could be a bit more general about this. And in fact, in our model, it's a bit simpler even than when I just explained what one really needs is these three terms that play off against each other in this way. It didn't need to be that this power was 2, it could have been 0, and this could have been 2, and in fact that's how it works in the ball that we actually worked out so far. So generally you need something like this with n to be bigger than n1. I also should emphasize that I'm giving you, again, what I think is the gist of this, a simple way of comparing the two cases that shows this qualitative difference between ADS case, which is non-compact, and DS case, which is compact. But the DS case is quite a bit more complicated. There are other scale fields around, and that equation I solved was basically done by taking the other scalars to be temporarily at zero velocity, so I didn't put their kinetic energy in. And you know, in the de Sitter case, taking out one ingredient makes the whole thing time dependent in a more complicated way. But having defined what we mean by this, which is what I've just written, you get this compactness. And one of the nice things about this particular case where these powers are like I've written here is that what otherwise would have been singularities, curvature singularities here just become conical singularities. And so that's much more easy to understand. That's actually also an interesting analogy between this radial evolution and, of course, in cosmological evolution. There generically will be singularities here which have to do with oriental folds coming together and other complicated physics. But anyway, in this example, we just basically evade that question. Okay, so just again to flash the cartoon of the result, what's happened so far is that we get this qualitative jump from the ADS kind of brain construction to the DS kind, which is compact, which is going to introduce two throats, and that, you know, work that matches well with this macroscopic slicing of the sitter space that I explained at the beginning. But now we know, and if, you know, I do provide you with some example of this, what the microscopic ingredients really were that built up these throats. So the other thing that I should explain in these general terms is that when you, these ingredients that you add, well, as I'll explain more, are relatively simple so that you can keep track of what it did to the throat, to the degrees of freedom that are built up by this brain construction. So what'll happen is this process of uplifting will introduce things like flavor brain, that I mentioned before. So you'll still have a kind of Yang-Mills theory, but with some extra flavors, but not a large number of them. And this wiggly black line is meant to describe these orientifolds, which introduce negative tension, but just project the gauge theory content by a kind of Z2 factor. So they don't make a huge effect on the content of the theory. Gary?
Fields and stuff, but they're still coupled to gravity?
They're coupled to gravity in the D minus 1 dimension.
Okay.
But the D minus 1 Planck mass is huge. It's ramped up by, like, the geometry of the throat, the size of the throat, the volume of the whole compactification down to D minus 1, or on the, in the field theory terms, it's ramped up by the species number, by the centrifuge. So, in fact, actually, maybe it's worth getting to the, ask this question, it's perhaps worth saying this now. So here are the scales, which is basically I think what you're asking about. So, you know, below this cutoff scale, you have this pair of Yang-Mills sectors. Then you cross this 1/L scale, and before you get anywhere near the D minus 1 dimensional Planck mass scale, which is huge, of the entropy factor, you have this huge window to wonder about. There's a window of this which is accessible through classical gravity calculations on the bulk side, right? Because if you look at processes that are still low energy compared even to the d-dimensional Planck mass, then you know you can study physics there as well. So. Okay. So I think this is okay. All right. So you know, it's been just sort of in a sort of qualitative sense, one's first reaction to making some neutral black hole or some neutral or the sitter would be to just add energy with brains and anti-brains and try and add it up. And you know, that of course doesn't work in itself. If you just put together brains and anti-brains alone, the weak coupling, you have all sorts of instabilities. But this is, in some sense, in spirit, the logical conclusion of that idea. We have landed on a situation where we're going to need these brains and anti-brains, but we're doing it in a way where we include all the other details, you know, ingredients that are required to stabilize the instabilities that one needs to worry about to get a solution. But, you know, morally speaking, I think it is sort of what you'd like to have. And I just say, there's an interesting paper about neutral black holes by Danielson and company. It's been around for a while that gets some nice results thinking about brains and anti-brains for black holes as well.
Table, right?
In that case, it's the fact that you, so it's also the temperature, right?
Yeah, but that's part of the thermalization procedure, if you wish,
Yes. So here it's also that you have many. I mean, so you can take this system and, you know, I'm drawing the same cartoon that one would draw on the ADS side, but in both cases, one is really working in the regime's large G-string SC where the brain is in flux, and as in response to this question, you
have an instability from them, but only a non-instability can be suppressed schwing or decay. But you know, I think there are some good similarities and some important differences between the two cases, but this is, I think, the moral equivalent. Okay. So,
you don't want to compete with the with this situation anyway.
Well, I'd be shocked to get one, yeah.
This is my best.
Right, so this is all metastable. This is excellent. Okay, so what techniques do we use? So, one of them, actually, the kind of,
from my point of view, the sort of breakthrough that happened technically was in this paper with Joe, where we just thought about it that way, even for the purpose of studying ADS-CFT dual pairs, where you might want to look for solutions where the internal dimensions aren't as gigantic as the curvature radius of ADS. So even in ADS-CFT, that's a very extreme limit. And one can, in that context, and furthermore in this context of uplifting all the way to the sitter, ask what can you do to overcome this negative potential energy from positive curvature. And there's a nice, there probably are many ways to do this, but one method, which was actually reviewed in Jonathan's talk this morning, in effect, is to counteract the curvature of the sphere with curvature that comes from variations of some torus elsewhere in the geometry. So in the F-theory stuff, this comes from the variation of the axion dilaton, which is a little bit more abstract. In this context, we have a torus here at our disposal, and we can make it vary over the space in a way that is relatively easy to describe using supersymmetric sigma models and using the same kind of techniques that people use for F-theory. And, you know, the variation of this torus contributes positively to the potential energy. It counteracts the curvature. This is familiar in the case which people have often studied, where you take such a variation to precisely cancel the curvature of the base and consider a Calabi-Yau manifold that's an elliptic vibration over some positively curved base. But, you know, mathematically there's a whole spectrum of possibilities that include either exactly canceling or under-canceling or over-canceling the curvature of the base. And you have some control over the geometry of just that part of the problem through these kinds of methods. In fact, in our example, our uplifting comes more from brains than from this, but this is part of the technique. As I keep emphasizing, orientifolds produce crucial negative contributions to the potential. And you can see that both in the four-dimensional description and in the 10-dimensional description. But I'll kind of skip over that. We, of course, one of the techniques is to ensure that we have control, and we insist on perturbative control, so we just set it up so that the radii end up much bigger than the string scale. And also there's been interesting recent work, well, not so recent, that describes how to properly incorporate or bound the warp factor that can contribute also to the potential energy. Let me just quickly describe this. This is sort of more for the benefit of string theorists who tend to focus a lot on supersymmetry, whereas here we're just going to use, 10-dimensional supersymmetry will play a role, but all that one needs for control really is old-fashioned perturbation theory. That's consistent if you end up in a situation with weak couplings and weak curvature. So there's just trade-offs in this game as to how much supersymmetry you want to include. Supersymmetry is helpful in canceling quantum corrections to things and, forcing, say, the potential energy to have a certain structure, which allows you, in some cases, to push from very weak coupling to very strong coupling. But because of the special constraints of supersymmetry, it also prevents there being certain terms in the effective potential that could otherwise be there, certain forces that play off of other forces to stabilize things. And so, there are trade-offs. Sometimes that's helpful, sometimes it's not. So in any case, here we're looking for the simplest kind of de-sitter solution that can be made explicitly. So for that purpose, I've always found that the perturbative approach is easier. In particular, the proposals so far for stabilizing all moduli in this low-energy supersymmetric case work perfectly well, but they involve a stabilization of perturbative against non-perturbative effects, which requires, you know, that much more of a large coefficient in front of the second term. Anyway, that's that. Okay, so finally, let me just explain the concrete example of what I've said. So again, the basic picture is to look for what happens to the brain construction and introduce ingredients that uplift the de-sitter and see what they look like in detail. So we're doing this ADS3 model, which begins with color brains that are D1s and D5s. What we have to add to find de-sitter solutions in this context, at least as we've done it, is, I guess, four extra stacks of objects, one of which is the kind of elliptic vibration that I just described, the oriental folds that I've been emphasizing, and then certain other kinds of brains, called Nevill-Schwartz brains and certain wrapped D brains. And one nice feature of this is that almost all of these ingredients are pairwise mutually supersymmetric. So, you know, part of the technical challenge of this kind of thing is to ensure that the effective potential that you write down is reliable for the four-dimensional or three-dimensional, in this case, description, without having to keep track of all of the various KK modes in the internal geometry. And aside from these brains and anti-brains, which are separated in the Wilson line direction by Wilson line vacua that I can explain or probably we'll get to, all these things are mutually supersymmetric pairwise. And so the interaction energies between them are suppressed. Long story short, this is the potential energy for those moduli having uplifted to the sitter. In the end, you find this. I don't want to go through the details and bore you with it, but in the end, you find a solution at low curvature. One can show that the warp factor is, it always has to be present at some level when you have these objects internally, which are localized in addition to other objects, which are smeared out, in order to solve the 10-dimensional equations of motion. One can obtain a situation where those warp factors are playing that role, but are still small enough that they don't contribute a leading contribution to the moduli potential. So you worry about all those things. You worry about other directions in scalar field space, like certain anisotropies. And you worry about this one sector that was not supersymmetric, which has a neat stabilization mechanism coming from some orbifold with Wilson line vacua that are very massive and stabilize these things relative to each other. I'm going very quickly over this because we're running out of time, but there's a solution, this sitter solution that we think is under control because the curvatures are weak and the couplings are weak. And so we can therefore present this computation of the entropy that I mentioned at the beginning. So this is a situation which in anti-de-sitter space came from the D1, D5 black hole, whose entropy is related to the central charge of the 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT on D1 brains and D5 brains. There was an orbifold action by K, which enhances it to K times N1 and 5. And there's one slightly tunable small parameter epsilon that appears that I've also kept track of here that occurred also in the earlier work with Joe. That enhances the entropy in a way that also makes sense from the Yang-Mills point of view in terms of, just like in orbifold theories, quiver theories, for people who are familiar with that, one obtains light degrees of freedom that come from sectors of strings that wind around the base of the cone as many times as you can do before they unwind by going around the tip of the cone. And in terms of all these parameters, the entropy that we get in our system, you know, is parametrically of this order. And so the so far we've seen that the brain construction develops these two throats both macroscopically and microscopically, and we know what these degrees of freedom are. It's this UN times UN system with flavors and an oriental projection, and that gets the entropy right parametrically. So now let me say a little bit more about the holographic duality that comes out in this way, since the microscopics and macroscopics seem to line up. So again, as in response to Gary's question, I already flashed the basic scales of this problem. One has this field theory, which is describing the system at very low energies, but it's cut off and coupled to gravity. In this case, it's Liouville gravity because it goes down from three to two dimensions. And even macroscopically, one can compute all sorts of things about the system, in particular using the controlled window one has on the gravity side between the cutoff scale and the bulk Planck scale, which itself is well below the scale of the minus one dimensional Planck mass. So you do computations in the bulk, even macroscopically, to establish things like that the total central charge of the system is zero, as it should be for a theory with gravity. So this is like a Liouville theory with a large central charge matter sector. The total central charge is zero, although the matter effective central charge is very large. One can compute tunneling amplitudes between the two throats, which we did in the old days in other warped compactifications, to find what kinds of couplings there are between the two sectors, and the scale of the suppression of the higher dimensional operators that couple the two throats. You get some interesting results from that. One can study both macroscopically and microscopically the decays of the sitter. One of the decay modes that is very interesting is this one where the brains and anti-brains annihilate through a Schwinger decay process. And, you know, all these things can, as usual, be described on both sides, at least qualitatively. Anyway, I don't really have time to explain any of these things in detail. So let me just summarize and say what the open questions are. So again, the main motivation of this was to understand the sitter holography microscopically by building up from ADS-CFT dual pairs. And for that purpose, we didn't even bother to work in the realistic dimension. But this is also part of an ongoing program to develop simpler and simpler models of the sitter space, partly for this reason, but partly for other obvious reasons. This business of uplifting with curvature coming from elliptic vibrations is a clear direction to take. It's related to other works also going on. Brett and company have done interesting models along these lines also. One of the things that's amusing here is that I've given you the microscopics of the dual, but in the form of a brain construction. There might be a more useful way of presenting it, including the effects of the elliptic vibration and all of that. Sometimes, at least in recent developments in string theory, it's turned out just as useful to present a field theory just directly in terms of some brain construction. It's often as useful as any other presentation of the theory. One can compute only a certain number of things, and this is how the theory has been presented so far. So there's a lot of interesting questions about the physics of the UV cutoff, the coupling between the two throats, UN theories, and ultimately the interpretation of the amplitudes in this theory is something that we'd like to understand a lot better. You know, there's one situation in which we understand what to do with this system of Liouville theory coupled to a large central charge matter sector, which is world G string theory, the supercritical version. And there one is computing basically some S matrix, but it's not at all clear that that's the right interpretation in this context, although it's the same kind of theory. So let me just leave you with that. Ask your question.
Any questions? Yes?
So this is just describing one causal patch of the de Sitter?
Yeah, these coordinates cover one causal patch. A little bit more if you want to go beyond the causal patch in the D-1 description. So it's kind of like, you know, in the SCFT you can study the Poincaré version, which covers the Poincaré patch. This one we land on formulates directly this patch of de Sitter, which includes a causal patch. You know, there's a point of view where you want to stay within a causal patch anyway, because that's what the single observer can see. But a very interesting question is, can you see behind this horizon? Perhaps in the kind of way that Gary was talking about in Black Hole earlier. So, but yeah, short answer, yes, this is covering a patch of the scene.
In the work of Danielson et al., the tachyons of the D-Dibbach system played an important role. Now, somehow I missed that part here.
Well, here we're way away from any regime where there are tachyons, because we're at strong G string N, these cage theory sectors, right? So those color bands really should not having generated the flux that is helping stabilize the internal dimensions. And so, again, there aren't explicit brains and anti-brains around anymore. There's just a strongly coupled version of the theory that you get by starting with brains and anti-brain. However, there's a non-determinative decay that would involve Schwinger pair production of brains and anti-brains, which one can then study in this language.
Okay, well, I think we should stop for the break, so let's thank our speaker again.